House Committee on Business and Labor for February 6, 2003. I'd like to, before we get started, there were two people I did not introduce the other day, and our committee assistant, Brandon Persinger, then also, well, we have a policy graduate student from University of Oregon that's doing a lot of the policy analysis for us, and that's Kate Coey. So I forgot to introduce them. Okay, I'd like to open a work session for the adoption of the committee rules. We didn't do this the other day because we were not formal. Yes, Mr. Barton.
Madam Chair, I move to, we adopt the proposed committee rules.
Okay, Representative Barton moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion carries. The rules are adopted. I'm going to close the work session on the adoption of committee rules. And I would...
Yes? Adoption of the committee bills?
Okay. No, I just did that one. And I would like to now open a work session for introduction of committee bills. Mr. Barton? The one thing about committee rules is that the voice to introduce the committee bills does not indicate one's support for the concept, but only to have the concept introduced as a bill so it can be referred to other committees for possible consideration. Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move the following legislative concepts to be introduced as committee bills. It's LC 758, 1324, 1325. Would you prefer that I read the dates?
Yes, please.
Strike that, Madam Chair. I'm going to I'm going to start my motion over again. My motion is going to be longer than I would have phrased it myself. Madam Chair, I move LC Draft 758, dated 12/20/2012. LC Draft 1324, dated October 8, 2012. LC Draft 1325, dated October 9th, 2012. LC Draft 1405, dated October 19th, 2012. LC Draft 1640, dated November 21st, 2012. And LC Draft 1761, dated October 24th, 2012, be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, Representative Barton moves that LC Draft 758, 1324, 1325, 1405, 1640, and 1761 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection that these bills be drafted as committee bills? Okay, hearing no objection, the motion carries and the LC drafts will be introduced as committee bills. I'd like to close the work session for introduction of committee bills and open the public hearing on House Bill 2111.
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 2111, it revises the standard for determining whether a person is substantially limited in their major life activity for the purposes of employment discrimination. No impact on this bill, and there's no fiscal impact either. Excuse me, I'm sorry. There could be a fiscal impact. We have not requested it at this point until the work session is scheduled, so we do not know if there's a fiscal impact.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. We have one, two, three, four, about five people speaking for the bill. I would like to call up Elizabeth Kershaw. And how about Bob? And I never can pronounce your last name, Bob. I'm sorry. Who are speaking for the bill. So those two at the same time. Welcome. And if you're reminding all of the folks that are going to be testifying, if you will make sure that you introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record and for the first time, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, Legislative Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you so much for hearing this bill today. House Bill 2111 simply conforms state and federal language in regard to ADA and ADAA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the American with Disabilities Act as amended. In 2009, Oregon amended our laws to conform with the federal laws. Unlike the federal laws, LC drafted the word, as you will see in the the first section of your one pager here that materially restricts, that was inadvertently used as a qualifier to talk to the limitation of life activities due to impairment. In effect, it raised the standard over the federal standard, and it goes against the congressional intent to provide broader protections for individuals with disabilities. You'll see in 2011, responding EEOC clarified that language, and I have on your sheet both bolded and italicized it, that the impairment need not prevent or significantly or severely restrict, which is the same thing as materially. So the feds absolutely clarified this just 2 years ago. We'd like to remove the word materially to conform with federal standard.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Junda?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon is a federally funded nonprofit that provides legal assistance to people with disabilities to enforce their civil rights and access to services. I'm here to support House Bill 2111 and perhaps give a little background about why it's an appropriate step to take for state law. Excuse me. The Congress of the United States made amendments to the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, about 5 years ago in order to make some modifications to clarify what Congress's meaning was when it originally passed the ADA in 1990. The U.S. Supreme Court had made a number of decisions that had narrowed the applicability of the ADA, and Congress wanted to put it back on the footing that it originally intended. After Congress took that action, the various federal agencies wrote regulations to interpret the act as they do. And now we have a body of law that has been created from those amendments to the ADA. Part of the configuration of federal law and state law in this area is that state law cannot limit the rights that are afforded under the federal ADA. It can't expand them. So the state of Oregon could decide to provide greater protections against disability discrimination than the federal government does. But it cannot limit the applicability of the ADA in Oregon. So in other words, that if Oregon law provides fewer protections for people with disabilities, a person with disabilities can look to the federal law for protection. Because Oregon has recognized that for many, many years, your body has made a decision to try to keep the federal and state law pretty as close as possible. And that's exactly what this amendment would do, because as Ms. Kushwa pointed out, the EEOC has looked at the federal law, and the federal law is pretty clear in terms of its intent that the decisions in terms of whether a person is disabled or not disabled should be decided on a broader standard, if you will, and that the focus of disability discrimination, rather than focusing on whether a person is disabled or not, should focus more on an act of discrimination. Is a person being discriminated against because of a disability rather than focusing on the existence of a disability? So that's the general overall scheme. And for that reason, we think it's appropriate to keep state law as close as possible to federal law, because if it isn't, it's just misleading to businesses, employers, and others who may look to state law and say, well, those are the rules that I have to play by, when in fact they're not. The federal law would in fact be the rules of the game, and to have state law that's not consistent with it is just going to be confusing and have some potentially perverse results.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Committee members, do you have any questions of the panel? Representative Barton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you help me understand what this deletion of the word means in applied terms? Is there any case law that's focused on the word material? Is this actually going to change law as is applied in Oregon? Has anyone been denied benefits or been denied a claim because of the word materially?
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, I don't have the answer to that question, but I can get back to you with that information.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Representative Barton, I don't believe so. I haven't seen any cases that have looked at the term materially. But there is case law out there on the new ADAAA, the federal law, that again interprets the standard for disability more broadly than it used to be under federal law.
Okay, any other questions of the panel? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony today. And kind of come on the same line of questioning, I'm curious, since federal law is the standard in which we have to meet, and our law is not meeting it, why would somebody not propose just to eliminate our law and just use the federal law? That seems like that would be a lot clearer than us consistently trying to chase the federal law.
Chair Doherty, Representative Freeman, again, that seems to make a lot of sense to me, but I don't have the answer to that question. I'll get back to you with that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, we've worked to try to bring our state law into conformance with federal law so that there's a local affirmation of the rights of the people with disabilities and access to standards that were within state regulation, again, to guide businesses and to resolve disputes that may occur between employees, employers, and in other forms. So from our perspective, it allows for a more local affirmation and enforcement of the standards.
Chair Doherty, Representative Freeman, in addition, the Bureau of Labor and Industries has a contract with the federal government and to enforce the civil rights discriminations as these. And so it will help to clarify our own contractual agreements as well.
And just a quick follow-up.
Please.
And thank you for that answer. And as a person that employs people and follows these laws, I will tell you flat out, it would be easier for me when I was looking for this if I looked up the state law and said, hey, just refer to the federal, it's the standard, and I didn't have to try to read through the state and figure out what the words meant. I'm not an attorney like some of the other folks. It would just be a much simpler and clearer for me to say the federal law is the standard, follow that, and all would be good. Just an opinion. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Holby?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can appreciate Representative Freeman's issues, but and I'm not absolutely positive of the reasoning behind that, but I think I've asked Legislative Council similar questions before, and I don't believe that we're able to defer our statutory framework and legislative responsibility to the federal government just by reference.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment, I guess, than a question, but in reference to Representative Freeman's question, when someone has been harmed under a federal law, they can bring a claim in both state and federal court, but the person defending the claim could remove the case to federal court if it's only under a federal statute. But if they chose to want to bring their claim in state court, then they would need to have to be just bringing their claim under a state statute. And so just in pragmatic terms, to have both a federal law and a state law, that way that if a person who was harmed or alleged to be harmed wanted to bring a claim, they could remain only in state law by bringing it under the Oregon Disabilities Act as opposed to having to go to the federal law. So that's just a pragmatic reason for having two separate, even though they might be worded exactly the same, it's a reason for having a state statute and a federal statute, just under my understanding.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to now call up Ms. J.O. Wilson and Ms. Jan Meekums. And the other two people we have on the list, which we'll call afterwards, are Jim Gessinger and Kurt Arthur.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries on this issue. I'm going to make a blanket statement, and then I'm going to walk it back a little bit. My blanket statement at the outset is that we don't support House Bill 2111. we agree with what Elizabeth testified to, and Boley's contention is that the word materially it probably exceeds the federal standard and does not conform. Where we would disagree is that simply removing the word materially brings us into conformity with the federal statute. A couple of reasons that we are particularly sensitive to the issue of disability discrimination law as it relates to this bill. A couple of points. First, state law goes down to the very small business level where federal law does not. Federal law goes down to employers of 15 or more. State law goes down to employers of 6 employees or more. So the Oregon law is broader in those terms. The Oregon law also encompasses more conditions than what you see in federal law and federal regulation. In my testimony, I've outlined a couple, but there are a couple that are unique to Oregon law. You'll see on that long list on the bill in front of you on sub S, socializing, sub W, employment, sub X, ambulation, sub Y, transportation, and then sub double A, ability to acquire rent or maintain property. Those are all unique conditions to the Oregon law that currently do not exist in federal regulation. Where our concern is with this bill is that you take the word materially out, which we acknowledge is probably a higher bar than the federal. You take that out, then we would argue you're actually proposing a lower bar than what exists in federal statute, because you're taking the word materially out, but what you're not reinserting into House Bill 2111 are the sideboards that currently do exist in federal law that would not exist in state law. And when I say that, there are a couple of provisions. Actually, Elizabeth has one here on her 2111 statement right before the bolded down at the bottom. One of the sideboards in federal law is that an impairment is a disability within the meaning of this section if it substantially limits the ability of an individual to perform a major life activity. And this is the key statement, as compared to most people in the general population. That is something that we would need to see in the state statute in order to be comfortable moving forward. There's also another sideboard in federal law. Let me get to it. Actually, it's the sentence that just is after the one that, that Elizabeth includes, but it's not included in her testimony. And it is, nonetheless, not every impairment will constitute a disability within the meaning of this section. That's another sideboard in federal law, however meager, but it is a sideboard nonetheless that we feel would put us into true conformity with federal law, as opposed to removing the word materially, and we would argue setting the bar lower than what exists in federal law. So we would not support 2111 as it exists, but what I am saying is there's definitely a roadmap for us to get there, because if it's an issue of conformity, then we would appreciate a more precise conformity than just removing the word materially out of the statute.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Ms. Meekham.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekhams, the State Director for National Federation of Independent Business, NFIB Oregon. I represent 7,500 small business Main Street businesses in the state, and NFIB is also opposed to House Bill 2111 as it is presented. The question materially came up, and I thought it was might be appropriate to actually look up the definition, and it is stated something that substantially changes something or is big enough to make a difference. And when you remove materially from the definition of restricts, I think it definitely broadens it to make it different application than what was originally intended, and as has already been stated by J.L. Wilson, at conforming to the federal law. Regarding small businesses, we are a small business state. I won't, and this application could have such an adverse impact on small businesses having to comply with this broadened definition that I feel it cannot be understated. I know you have a lot to do today, so I don't want to take up a lot of your time. You can read my testimony, but for all of the reasons previously stated and the fact that it would so adversely potentially affect small businesses, jobs, and the economy in Oregon, we are opposed to this bill. And if we, too, feel that if it were aligned to the federal definition, that we could get on board with it. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Committee members, any questions of the panelists? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Kurt Arthur and Jim Gessinger. Hopefully I didn't butcher your names. Thank you, sir. Make sure you state your names for the record.
Madam Chairman, Chairwoman and members of the committee, my name is Kurt Arthur. I am a commercial real estate agent and small business owner. I own a commercial real estate company here in Salem by the name of Sperry Van Ness. I'm here today on behalf of supporting the Chamber, Oregon State Chamber of Commerce's position in opposition to 2111. In my career as a commercial real estate agent, I'm here on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, but I hold a dual position. Why this matter is very important to me. In commercial real estate, I deal with ADA issues all the time. Every single building we work with a client, whether it be to develop, whether it be to sell, whether it be to lease, whether it be to retrofit, we have to deal with ADA laws all the time. I can tell you half a dozen cases every single year we have where that throws a monkey wrench into small businesses looking to expand, because unfortunately, while we talk about trying to pair Oregon laws into federal laws, that is not the case. Oregon laws are much more restrictive than state laws, and unfortunately, we won't get into it, but city interpretations can then be different from state and federal as well. So I have a material interest in this. And then additionally, being a small business owner, I employ 8 people. I fall in that nice little niche where I'm impacted by state disability laws, and I actually employ a person with disabilities compared to the 15, I believe it is, from a federal standpoint. So in a time when we are coming out of an economy where we are trying to do every little thing we can to boost jobs, to get people back to work, I'm just absolutely opposed to anything that we've removed of the word material. We talked about the absolute mundane. Does that mean that a person with a really bad bunion who keeps them from walking, does that, I mean, that's how obscure this could be interpreted if the word material is taken out. So I don't do this for a living. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I'm just a small businessman that came down today to tell you my thoughts. I'm stand with the state Chamber of Commerce in opposition to House Bill 2111.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Gessinger?
Madam Chair, my name is Jim Gessinger. I work for Associated Oregon Loggers here in Salem. Our association represents almost 1,000 small businesses that are involved in the contract logging business, either directly or indirectly. These are small family-owned companies that typically employ between 6 and 12 employees. We do have some larger companies that employ over 100, but they're in the minority in our business. Safety is the number one concern to contract loggers. Our association has 8 people on staff that are involved in loss control and return to work activities, and we do everything possible to make sure our members minimize the number of visit incidents they have, and particularly lost time accidents that potentially disable employees. We're committed to that. But I must say that the House Bill 2111 is exactly the type of law or proposed law that make our members scratch their heads as to why they want to be in business in the state of Oregon. Current law exceeds the standards that the federal government imposes on small businesses in Oregon, and if anything, we think that Oregon ought to be compliant with federal laws. At best, this is very bad timing to be proposing changes at this time. Our industry has been through 3 of the worst years it has ever experienced, the worst recession that Oregon has seen, and certainly that the forest products industry has seen in modern times. We are at the beginning of a recovery. The recovery is in its infancy, and this is the type of law that would pull the rug right out from underneath that recovery and make it more difficult to keep the recovery sustained and to keep people employed and to keep taxpayers paying taxes. And that's what I think this session of the legislature is all about. That's what the governor said his agenda is, and that's certainly the agenda that our association wants to pursue as well. Rather than bore you with any more details, I'd just like to say that the previous panel articulated the concerns of our association quite well. We are opposed to this bill. We would entertain a modification to make Oregon's procedures compliant with federal law, but to go beyond what we currently have as articulated and described in House Bill 2111 is something we can't support. Thank you.
Fine. Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And sir, I recognize you don't necessarily speak on behalf of the Oregon Chamber of Commerce. So, to the extent you want to weigh in, I'll just ask for your personal opinion if you feel comfortable sharing it. But Mr. Wilson in the previous panel indicated that perhaps a more precise wording so that it more precisely mirrored the federal standard, that is potentially something that his organization could live with. If we were to do that so that it was more precise, and I frankly don't, if we were to delete the word materially, I just don't know how much gap there is, frankly, between a more precise wording and what a simple deletion does. But if it could be more precise, is that something then you could then live with?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Barton, sometimes precision can be a slippery slope as well. I think all laws have to have some flexibility, but the word materially was proposed to be eliminated for a reason, and I suspect a lawyer that's a lot smarter than I am was behind doing that. There was a reason for that being removed, and we think the intent was to make it easier to get on disability and to file disability claims, and harder to put people back to meaningful employment, which is the goal of everybody that is unfortunate enough to have a workplace accident. So I would just reiterate again that we would support consistency with the federal law.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Fagan.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just so that I understand what you would support, you're saying that you would support Oregon law if it basically raise the number of employees that an employer needs to have in order to be covered under. Is that what you're saying? Or you still support, okay, so you still would support Oregon law covering six or more employees. So I understand you say compliant with federal law. You're not saying you want the exact same employee number standard.
Madam Chair and Representative Fagan, let me make this clear. My reference to the number of employees was simply a reference that in some ways Oregon's laws are far more strict than federal laws. I am here mainly to tell you of my objection, as Mr. Wilson and others before me have said, of the removal of the word materially. That creates a huge sea of ambiguity that opens itself up to all the issues that all the speakers prior to me have met. That's my number one opposition.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much testifying. You guys did great. I'd like to close the works or the public hearing on House Bill 2111 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2112.
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 2112, it authorizes the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to assess a civil penalty up to $1,000 for certain actions relating to employee payroll deductions.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to call up again Elizabeth Kushwa and Gerard Talbot from Boley. Thank you. And then we'll call up the people that are also signed in. Thank you very much.
Good morning again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, Legislative Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2112 proposes to make conform the penalties available under violations of 652610, which is the time, the statute which enumerates what deductions an employer may make from an employee's paycheck and for what reasons. In 2007, this body amended the statute to include a time frame in which an employer must repay the employee's wages if they were unlawfully deducted. When that happened, they also imposed a civil penalty of $1,000 for that violation of that portion of the statute. We'd like the tool to be able to apply that to the rest of the statute. In other words, so if an employer unlawfully deducts and pays back outside of the time frame, they are civilly penalized, whereas if an employer unlawfully deducts for other reasons, they are not subject to a penalty. As of now, when a claim comes in, we investigate the claim. If the claim is found to be credible, the only tool we have is to say, you must pay back the employee. And for the most part, that's what people do. However, sometimes we encounter a few bad actors, a few frequent flyers who really don't want to do that. The only recourse, there is a criminal recourse. It is a Class D misdemeanor, which is a maximum violation of $250. And having just come from the criminal world, I can tell you there is no case, there's not an office out there who's going to have the resources to take a case like that. That's a very difficult standard to ask. We just like the tool to use for those very, very few people who are unlawfully deducting from their employees' paychecks and doing it time and again. With me is Gerhard Teubel. He's our Wage and Hour Division Administrator, and he is a much smarter mind than I on this issue.
Thank you, sir.
For the record, my name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm the Administrator of the Wage and Hour Division, Chairman Doherty, members of the committee. I understand that there is some concern about what Boley is trying to, what problem Boley is trying to solve by proposing this fix to the statute. And I would say two things. One, Elizabeth has already alluded to, is that currently we have a violation for which we do not have a civil penalty. Typically, for all the laws that we enforce, there's a violation and there's a civil penalty. So in cases where it's determined that an employer has habitually violated the law or has egregiously violated the law, there is some recourse other than just making the employee whole and recovering the wages that haven't been paid. Currently, as Elizabeth pointed out, all there is a criminal penalty, which is neither practical, as she mentioned, nor is it the preferred practice of the agency to pursue criminal penalties against employers for infractions of this kind. A civil penalty is a much better way for us to address a recurring problem. Secondly, I would also point out that even if Boley wanted to impose a penalty, an employer, of course, has a right, or any person has a right, to respond to that action, to request an administrative hearing, to have the case heard, and to make the case that the penalty is unwarranted. Beyond that, Boley has a standard to meet in that a penalty, when it's imposing a penalty, the violation must be willful. So this does not address cases where an employer, for example, inadvertently deducts something from an employee's wages that shouldn't have been deducted or even mistakenly does that. We are looking for cases where, you know, an employer has willfully made these deductions that do not conform to what the law is. Thank you for your time this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions to the panel? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony today, and I want to applaud you on finding a violation that didn't have a civil penalty. I didn't know those existed still, so you must have done some research there. In part of Elizabeth's testimony, she talked about finding bad actors and people to do it time and time again. However, the proposed legislation doesn't talk about scaling the penalty up, you know, first time, second time, third time. It talks about it right out of the gate. So I'm curious, was there any thought or discussion about first offense, second offense, up to what you described as a bad actor, or time and time again, giving them the maximum penalty of 1,000? It seemed like we can do 1,000 for the first one in this law.
Chairman Doherty, Representative Freeman. To my knowledge, no, there hasn't been discussion of scaling it that way. We do have some civil penalties which are scaled in the way that you mentioned. As a matter of practice, Boley, when it assesses a civil penalty, for example, does not necessarily seek the maximum penalty in every case. We have the discretion to look for a smaller penalty than the maximum.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up J.L. Wilson, Jan Meekum, and Ian Tolson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries on House Bill 2112. We would oppose House Bill 2112. I want to hopefully bring some more clarity to this issue. I want to be very clear. Employers who illegally or unlawfully deduct wages get hammered today. It's not an issue of is a civil penalty going to be a deterrent for employers who make deductions that are illegal or unwise or whatever. I am aware of a member today by virtue of a $65 deduction that was disallowed is now in $10,000 or more in court costs, reinstatement of those wages. The reason being is ORS 652-615 gives a civil right of action already on the illegal deduction of wages. So I don't want the committee to go away from this thinking there's no recourse against an employer. Not only is it a Class D misdemeanor, but there's also a private right of action for illegally deducted wages. It is a very, very expensive mistake with or without Boley's involvement on the civil penalty front. So what we're really talking about here is contained in 652, 610, sub 1 and sub 2. And this is the part, I guess you could argue that there are no civil penalties, and we're talking about itemized statements. Okay, but those subsections talk about the itemized statements you as an employer have to give an employee that says we deducted this much. We all get it on our pay stubs from the state or each of our employers. That's what those statutes govern. And I can just tell you from my employer's point of view, they do not want Boley in there regulating how they present their itemized statements or whether it's going to conform with something Boley wants. They just don't want that door opened. So if this is an issue of an actual illegal deduction of wages, employers are getting hammered today. If this is an issue about Boley regulating what your itemized statement looks like, that's a door that we'd rather keep shut. And so that's why we are not supportive of the measure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, once again for the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for National Federation of Independent Business Oregon, or known as NFIB. NFIB, representing our small business members, also oppose House Bill 2112. For all of the reasons that have previously been stated are absolutely true for us as well. I also know a member who made an inappropriate $20 deduction from the payroll of her staff of five, and she paid dearly for that. She obviously immediately corrected the mistake. The employees still took her to task, and it cost a lot of money and a lot of her time and energy to defend that. Our small members, typically in Oregon, we have less than 10 employees, our 7,500 members. We do have some that have 300 employees, but that also is an exception. They do not have an HR department. They do not have a payroll department. One mistake, they would have to then prove it wasn't willful, even though it may have been an innocent mistake. It is just a situation that we need to prevent and could be potentially egregious for our members. And with that, I conclude.
Thank you. Ian.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ian Tollison with Oregon Farm Bureau. Just would like to echo the sentiments of the previous speakers. We oppose the bill. This will just add another layer, a little bit more penalties to our membership, which are small business owners. And we don't see this as actually needed. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panelists? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and the other person signed up is Carl Harbaugh. Welcome, Mr. Harbaugh.
Good morning. My name is Carl Harbaugh. I own a company called Southtown Glass here in Salem. I'm a small business of 40 or so employees. Started business like 30-some years ago, and my wife and I, and we've grown into just a little under $7 million gross sale business. And if there's one thing we fear, It's our employees complaining to us about anything. You're just so much liability, just like they're saying. You don't mess with bully law. You do everything right. You get your deductions correct. They have so much clout right now. We fear for anything we do wrong. And to add this penalty or potential penalties is undue pressure upon small business. We're struggling now. We've got rules and regulations. We can't do work if we don't do things right. We can't bid school work. We can't meet certifications for insurance. Any of these things, violations that have to do with bully law, are already on our backs. And so there's no reason for this. There's absolutely no reason for this. I feel as though this is a little bit outside the box, but I feel as though we can't enforce the laws we have. We don't have enough manpower or force to take care of it, and now we're trying to mandate more laws. It just doesn't make sense to me. It's like, I don't know, it's if my wife went out with her credit card and started spending money and I had nothing I could do about it, I feel like that's what's happening here. So, you know, try to cut back, try to help small business.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Okay, any questions of Mr. Harbaugh? Thank you very much for your time. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2112 and open the work session and possible, the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2057. I'm going to player swap here. Okay, thank you. We have one person signed up on this bill, Thomas Irwin, but we're going to have Kate go through and talk about what the bill is before you come up. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2057 expands membership of the OLCC Alcohol Server Education Advisory Committee to include two educators and two representatives of alcohol server education providers. There's no fiscal or revenue impact on this bill.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Mr. Irwin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. House Bill 2057, which was pre-session filed, is an attempt by us to try to expand the Alcohol Server Education Advisory Committee membership. And so I would like to give you a little background about the Alcohol Server Education Program, which probably will help if you don't know much about it to understand why we're trying to do this. Oregon, among many of our first, we were the first in the nation to have an alcohol server education program mandated by the legislature and required of all people who serve alcohol by the drink. So those people that serve in bars and taverns and restaurants by the drink are required to have a service permit and have had to gone through an alcohol server education program. That program became effective back in 1985, so it's been in existence for a long time. As part of that legislation, there was also created an alcohol server education advisory committee to help advise the OLCC about curriculum and policy and other issues related to the education of servers. The reason that this legislation came about is greatly due to the hospitality industry, who pushed for it at that time back in 1985. They wanted to see that there had a professional force that was could be a positive, have a positive impact, if you will, in reducing alcohol-related problems such as serving to minors and over-service issues, to reduce those as well. So that was the primary impetus behind the Alcohol Survey Education Program. Oregon being the first, we now have 20 states plus Washington, D.C., who have mandatory alcohol server education programs, and 18 states who make alcohol server education available on a voluntary basis. So a lot of other folks have seen the efficacy of this and the reason behind it and have also joined in this effort. In 2007, the OLCC commissioners amended and approved rules to allow alcohol server education to also be formatted, if you will, or presented, if you will, online. previously to that time, prior to that time, it had been all in-classroom providers. Trying to keep up with the 21st century, I guess now that we're in the 21st century, there was an effort made to put it online, and that's proven to be extremely popular. In 2012, we saw over 30,000 individuals go through the alcohol survivor education program. And for Oregon, we have a total of 135,000 people that currently have their service permits. Service permits last for 5 years. So, and in that time, people need to come back and then get retrained. 80% of our folks go through the online providers currently, so it was extremely popular, as you can see, since 2007, and nowadays it's almost 80% of those folks go through the server education program online. Currently, there are 12 positions in our advisory committee. We're asking that, because it's in statute, that you expand that to 4 other positions. 2 of those seats would be available to represent both the in-classroom providers as well as the online class folks, because we don't have anybody currently on the advisory committee that can kind of give us that feedback on a constant basis. And the other 2 seats would be from give us education expertise or health education expertise that we currently don't necessarily have. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions of the panelists, Mr. Representative Thatcher?
Thank you, Tom, for coming in and talking about all the positive effects of having these server permits and all that. I'm thinking about how we're kind of an advisory committee of sorts here as legislators, and when we lack expertise in something, we just have people come in and speak. What would prevent the advisory committee from having, or commission, whatever it's called, from just calling in these experts rather than, permanently expanding, bigger and bigger and bigger to represent this and that other group, and just utilize the experts that are in the community when necessary?
Chair Doherty and Representative Thatcher, it's a great question. I don't think there's anything at all that prevents us from doing so. I think the idea here is to give these people a voice at the table on a consistent basis so that they actually could have a vote in whatever transpires on the committee. So it's mainly trying to give them legitimacy, if you will, because currently, while we do invite other people out from areas of expertise that aren't normally on the committee, they wouldn't necessarily have a vote if it came down to a voting type of situation. So that's probably the main reason, I guess, if you will. I think in the past, I have experts here that have been on the committee from the OLCC staff that could maybe answer this even better about asking for that expertise to come in. But I think it was more about, if you're going to look down this road for the future, we want to make sure that we're doing it correctly, appropriately. And things come up in committees that, not, as you well know, because you're on this committee, that aren't on the agenda, that we would want those people to be at the table so that they could make sure that their concerns are voiced. I think that's the other reason.
Yes, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Irwin, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
No one else has signed up. Is there anyone who is not signed up but would like to speak on this issue? Okay, seeing none, I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 2057, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2057. Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton has moved House Bill 2057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I have a question. Yes, does this have any fiscal impact that would have a referral? Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative, there's no fiscal or revenue impact for this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. We on this one are going to have a roll call vote, those in the opinion. And one thing I'd like to say is Representative Thompson is that the cold got the best of him this morning, so he did contact my office, and he is excused. But those of the opinion that House Bill 2057 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Excused.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, motion carries. Anyone want to carry this on the floor?
I could do it. Or you wanted to have one of our new ones?
Well, we have something else for her.
The 19-pager is my life.
Anyone want to, or would we like to just assign this? Mr. Kenner, or Representative Kenner, would you like to carry this? Okay, Representative Kenner will carry this on the floor. Close the work session on House Bill 2057. I open a public hearing on House Bill 2268. And the people we have to testify on this bill is, we have two. Is it Leonard Loader?
Lauder.
And Jim Dino. And before we you testify, I have been jumping the gun, so if you'd like to take a seat, we'll have our administrator go through over the bill.
Madam Chair and committee members, this is a bill that clarifies that firms must register with the State Board of Architect Examiners before providing services. Deletes requirement that firms renew annually in January, and it requires firms and individuals to renew their registration as provided by board rule. Changes the terms licensing to registering. It updates statutory references to the state building code. And clarifies that an injunction does not relieve individuals from the imposition of a civil penalty.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is James Deno. I'm the administrator for the Board of Architect Examiners. Thank you for taking a look at House Bill 2268 today. You should be getting a summary of what the bill is intending to do, as well as my written testimony. I won't torture you by sitting here and reading my testimony, but briefly describe what the bill intends to do and then take questions if you have any. This is a statutory housekeeping measure that in which we've tried to do several things. One is to update the definitions section and some of the terminology used in the statute. Also to clarify the language in the statute relating to architectural firms and construction documents such as drawings and specifications and plans. Also to clean up miscellaneous language such as usages of words must, shall, license, and registration. And then also to remove dates, licensing cycles, and deadlines from the statute, allowing those to be established by rule, which would open some opportunities for regulatory and process streamlining by our agency. So that's what the bill is all about. I'd be happy to take questions if you have any.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Loader.
My name is Leonard Loader. I'm a Salem architect and the current president of AIA Oregon. And I'm here today to urge support for HB 2268. I've also passed out some testimony as well, and I simply want to note that we've had excellent cooperation with the Board of Architect Examiners, the board, as well as the administrator, Jim Dental, and heartily support the work on this bill. If you have any questions, I'm here.
Are there any questions for the panelists? Mr. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't mean to monopolize the committee, but
okay.
I'm new to the committee, so I'm curious, was there a previous hearing or has there been discussion about some of the work you're doing? And I only say that because we've been talking about it now a couple minutes, and in a couple more minutes we're going to be asked to vote on it. And I've done this a couple times, and in the weeks coming, I get call after call from people in my district saying, what in the heck are you doing? So I'm just kind of curious, has there been, how big of a process has there been, and really how much are we changing?
Well, Chair Doherty and Representative Freeman, basically over time what's occurred is that laws change, codes change, terminology used in the industry practice of architecture change, and so different bits and pieces of the statute become dated or obsolete. And so what we've tried to do is gather those little issues together over time and put them all together into this bill. So it's truly what we call a housekeeping measure. So we're changing the definition of the state building code, for example. In the existing statute, it says that the state building code is the fire and life safety code. Well, the building code is much broader than that now. It includes a whole bunch of different codes, a whole package of codes. So we're changing that definition. That's an example of what this bill seeks to do. Also, in the architectural regulation business, the terms registration and license are used almost synonymously. And so we've tried to make it clear in the statute what we're talking about there. So that's hopefully answers your question. If not,
I was more curious about the public process. I'm confident what you're doing is the right thing. You believe you're doing the right thing. It's housekeeping.
Sure.
I'm more curious how many people outside this room have some idea what you're doing and who might be calling in the weeks coming.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, over the last year, we've had a number of public meetings on the issue. We have public board meetings every 2 months. So this bill has been talked about at least for a year in each of those meetings. And then we've gone through the notification process every time we have a meeting, taken public comment, and worked with the AIA all along the way.
If I may, Chair Doherty and Representative Freeman, that's another point that I wanted to make with regard to the level of cooperation that we've had with the Board of Architects and Examiners. We're not in, as such related other than the fact that they license us in the state. But they were very open to us. We have shared the progress on this part of the bill with our members, certainly with our board, and relayed concerns back to the board where such concerns existed. I doubt very much that you are going to see concerns raised as a result of the changes that are being made in this bill.
Great. And just as the final follow-up, if I do get those, I'll just forward them to you guys.
You sure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an important question.
Okay.
Representative Fagan.
Well, as this being my first public work session or public hearing and work session, I certainly appreciate the 19-page homework last night. That was wonderful reading, and I have a hunkering. I might need to know a little bit more about this bill than I had originally anticipated. So I did just have a couple of questions just regarding the reasons for. So you already explained licensing and registration being used interchangeably. I also noticed that throughout, the word supervising was changed to observing, the word plans were changed to drawings, and the words profession of was changed to the practice of. And I'm just curious if you could, you know, very just briefly and easily enlighten me on kind of the idea behind some of those word changes.
Sure. Chair Doherty, Representative Fagan, I can speak to a couple of those. Leonard can probably speak to one of them better than I can.
Yeah.
So the practice of, this is part of making the overall language plainer and is a recommendation of legislative council, simply. So that's the reason for that one. The supervising, observing issue is an architectural practice terminology change that Leonard can speak to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the issue on supervision versus observation is something that has sort of developed over time, and it relates a whole lot to contract law. As architects, we operate as owner's agents and not as the owner. So the direct contractual relationship that might exist between an owner and a contractor is one which we, and the results of which we can observe, we never have the opportunity to really supervise the way contract language has been written in the past. And so over the past, I would say, decade and a half, we've seen the language in AIA contract documents, as well as in state contracts, etc., move towards observation rather than supervision, because the supervision implies a level of liability with regard to the execution of the work that we practically can't see happening in the field, if that helps.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question, or?
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes.
You did your homework well, by the
yeah.
way.
Yes.
Okay, any other questions of the panel?
I just wanted to clarify, I think I know the answer to this, but I just want, I'm not sure if I missed it. So a foreign architect or a consulting architect that is licensed someplace else besides Oregon, when they do business in Oregon, they have to work through a registered architect, an architect that's registered in Oregon?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2268 and open a work session on House Bill 2268. Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd also note in the unlikely or possible event that it passes that Representative Fagan has demonstrated unusual mastery of this bill in this area of law. I think we'd make an excellent carrier.
Thank you for that suggestion. I think we may take it when we get to the end of here to find out who's going to carry the bill. Representative Barton moves House Bill 2268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none, those of the opinion that House Bill 2268 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Excused.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
I'm going to vote aye now and reserve the right to vote no on the floor.
Representative Holdy.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Henneman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Dorsey.
Aye. Okay, we do need a carrier for the bill. Representative Fagan, Representative Barton has suggested that you carry this to the floor. Would you be open to that?
I would be delighted to both supervise and observe the carrying of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you. So Representative Shamia Fagan will be carrying this on the floor. I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2268. Anything else for the good of the order? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two items, if I might. First of all, if we're going to be revisiting House Bill 2111 somewhere down the road, I would benefit from the offer, at least what I thought I heard as an offer, by some in the audience to try and find a common ground on that bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Kinnever also suggested that, and so I will get hold of the parties.
Thank you.
At the end of the meeting.
The other item, I asked a question in the last hearing regarding the benefits that were derived from workers' comp reform. I received some rather extensive information from DCBS yesterday, and I will tell you that it was comprehensive. It was very positive. It was an important story to be told. I recognize that our agenda is very tight, but I don't believe that we have the full story of how successful the reforms have been, absent the flip side of the coin, which is the benefit side, in addition to two decades worth of pure premium savings. So I was most impressed by the responsiveness of the department and of the very positive nature of their report.
Okay, a very good suggestion. Since so much of our work deals with workers' comp and workers' comp issues, that might be a very, very good suggestion. So I will ask our administrator to see if we can put it into the schedule for an informational hearing.
Thank you, Madam
from workers'
Chair.
Comp. Thank you very much. Anything else? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd echo the comments from Representative Kinnemer and, of course, Representative Witt on 2111. But I just want to say, you know, in this committee, oftentimes we're arguing with workers' comps, the ADA, and whatnot. And and sometimes it almost seems a little odd that we're somehow, I think we might appear callous to the public. Mm-hmm. And I want just to put on the record that we understand the there are folks with significant disabilities out there, and we have laws to protect their rights and to protect them as employees. And sometimes I think that the conversations head down a road that would appear as if we're not sympathetic to that situation. And I just want to, you know, would like to put on the record that I completely understand what we're trying to do with 2111, and I hope the parties come together, because I don't think it favors business or the employee themselves when we forget the fact that we're talking about disabled folks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Representative Thatcher.
More of a housekeeping question. Are these stacks of papers and reams of testimony going to be added to OLIS?
Yes. Some of them are on OLIS now. OLIS has just been rolled out, and a few hiccups as far as us being able to upload documents, but some are there, and the intent is to get everyone to submit their testimony to the committee by noon the day prior so we can get them all on
great.
OLIS.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Thank you. I think maybe when OLIS, the more and more the system is used, that people will get used to that. It's a very good system. Yeah. Very efficient. Well, thank you very much. Anything else to go to the order? Okay, I adjourn the meeting of the House Business and Labor Committee.
That was me.
Thank you.
Thank you.